Today's talk is co-sponsored by the Samuel Curtis Johnson Graduate School of Management here at Cornell. Please join me in welcoming Governor Subba Rao.
Professor Logawal and the Cornell academic community, thank you very much for making the Reserve Bank of India as an institution, and me personally, a part of the Aynori Center Distinguished Foreign Policy Speaker Series. I know that very well-known people have delivered speeches in this series, and I'm honored to add my name to that list. I'm going to be speaking this afternoon on India in a Globalizing World, some policy dilemmas. If you think about the global economy today, and if you think about the Indian economy today, there are lots of questions for which there are no answers. But there's one important question for which I have an answer, for which very few people have an answer. And that question is, when is this financial crisis going to be over? I assumed office as the governor of the Reserve Bank on the 5th of September 2008. If you look back 4 years, 5th of September 2008, Fannie and Freddie happened on the 7th of September 2008. AIG came to near collapse on the 10th of September 2008. And Lehman Brothers collapsed on the 15th of September 2008. So in India, people associate the crisis with me. This guy came as the governor and he brought the crisis on. So that's par for the course. I was appointed for 3 years. My term of appointment was coming to a close in September 2011, last year. And August last year, precise date is 4th of August last year, the government reappointed me for another 2 years. So see, from 2008 to 2011, the crisis was sort of ebbing. But when my reappointment came, the European crisis sort of picked up momentum. So I'm appointed for 2 more years until September 2013. So when is the crisis going to be over? September 2013. Thank you. So the first thing is today's macroeconomic situation in India is the cause for concern. Our growth has moderated. Investment, which is production capacity for tomorrow, has declined. Inflation is high and stubborn. And the rupee has depreciated quite significantly over the last 1 year. So there's quite a lot of concern. And the biggest concern by far is whether the India growth story, by which we set a lot of store, whether that growth story is being threatened by this current downturn. So if you want to look at the long-term growth trends in India, you see those bar charts which show growth from 92, 93 up until the most recent year, 11, 12. In the five-year period before the crisis, 2003 to 2008, India clocked growth of 8.7% on the average. If you take the three-year period, 2005 to 2008, India clocked growth of 9.3% on the average. So this growth story was celebrated in India. It was seen as India breaking away from what we call the Hindu rate of growth, the fatalistic rate of growth, that India was locked into a low growth syndrome. It was seen as breaking away from that. It set off aspirations for double-digit growth. And India was seen as the emerging economy with the maximum promise. For a long time, there was diffidence in India, believing that because we're a large economy, we cannot grow that fast like other smaller Southeast Asian economies have done. But China showed that it's possible, even for a large economy, to grow at double-digit speed for 15 years, year on year. And inspired by that, India thought that it too could grow. That growth story, first of all, what drove India's growth in the pre-crisis period, there are lots of explanations for this. Some people say that it's the result of the economic reforms that began in 1990. Some people say it's because of India's integration into the world. Some people attribute it to growing entrepreneurism. And at least a sizable number of people, somewhat of cynical disposition, say that it has nothing to do with India. It's just that the world was going through a very benign period of steady growth and low inflation, and India's growth story rode on the back of global great moderation. But what runs common through all the explanations is that India hit a sweet spot in the period, 5-year period before the crisis. The demographics dividend started paying off. The savings rate increased. The savings rate translated into investment, into production capacity. At the same time, productivity increased, with the result that there was more production. A lot of that production was consumed internally within the country, but much of it also was exported. So India had a great thing going in the period before the crisis. But that great growth story started fraying, beginning with the global crisis of 2008-09. In fact, before the global crisis, there used to be this intellectually fashionable view that some emerging economies have decoupled from the advanced economies. Why did they decouple? That they decoupled because of their improved macroeconomic management, because of their robust foreign exchange reserves, because of the way they protected, nurtured, and developed their financial markets and financial systems. It's because of all these reasons that even if advanced economies went into a downturn, it would not affect emerging economies like India, China, Brazil, Mexico, Turkey, etc. But the global financial crisis dented, if not completely rubbished, the decoupling view. All emerging economies were affected by the crisis, although to different extents. India was no exception. India came out of the 2008-09 crisis rather rapidly. But as we were coming out of that crisis, the Eurozone crisis hit us. And what is most distressing from a policy perspective for us today is that the policy space for crisis response today in 2012 is much less than what it was in 2008. In 2008, for example, as soon as Lehman Brothers collapsed, if you all throw back to that time, oil prices were global crude prices, which were running at $148 to a barrel, they plummeted to about $50 to a barrel. Inflation in India, which is very high, just suddenly came down. Our external sector at that time was very robust. We were on a path, credible path of fiscal consolidation. And so in 2008-09, India, like many other emerging economies, enjoyed space for monetary and fiscal stimulus. But today, and indeed over the last 1 year, we've been constrained for want of policy space. Inflation has been high. Oil prices, in spite of fragile recovery in America here, in spite of near recession or actual recession in Europe, oil prices are still very firm. India's external sector has now come under stress, as I will tell you about in a few moments. So today, India has no space for a policy response to the crisis. And because we have no space for a policy response, we are more vulnerable to the global downturn. So just to sum up today's current macroeconomic situation in India, growth is moderated, inflation is high and persistent, the balance of payments is under stress. We had a twin deficit problem, a current account deficit and a fiscal deficit. Investment has decelerated, and there's no policy space for stimulus. Having set that context, I want to address three major policy dilemmas that we have today, and those are three listed there. I'll spend a little longer on the first one and a relatively shorter time on the second and third. So the first dilemma that we have to address as policymakers is how do we manage the growth inflation dynamics. In order to appreciate this dilemma, let's look at the growth trends that shows the growth profile starting from 2006-07, a year before the crisis, up until the most recent year, 2011-12. You see that growth had declined quite steeply as soon as the 2008-09 crisis hit us. But then we recovered rather quickly. But since 2010-11, 2011-12, growth has decelerated. The 6.5% that growth that we clocked last year was lower than the growth that we achieved in the peak crisis year. In the peak crisis year of 2008-09, we had growth of 6.7%. So the growth of 6.5% last year was lower than the post-crisis growth. And this is the, as some students reminded me in an earlier session, this is the lowest growth that India had recorded in the last 9 years. Why is growth slowed? Growth is slowed, it's a tautological explanation, but growth is slowed because there is no investment taking place. Consumption, which held up India growth in the pre and post-crisis years, that is started slowing. And net exports, that is exports minus imports, that has started deteriorating. That's the growth story. What's the inflation story? Just look at the red line, which is the headline inflation. You know, actually, during the crisis, we had negative inflation. So many people in India were worried about whether we were going to have a deflation. And deflation, as all of you living in America and know, is much more disruptive than inflation. But we came out of that deflation actually rather quite quickly, and inflation started ratcheting up and hit about 10%, 11% at its peak in 2010. And then you see it remained fairly high in double-digit level for about 2 years. And starting January 2012, it has started moderating from, it's come down from above 10% to the most recent number of 6.9%. So what's driving inflation in India is an important question. There are several factors. Food inflation. Food inflation, there's a cyclical component, there's a structural component. The cyclical component is relatively easy to understand. If there is a deficient rainfall or if there is a supply problem, there could be high inflation. For example, India, sometimes we have high onion prices because onion is grown in part of the country and there's transport problems, cannot be distributed. So suddenly prices go up and that shows up in the headline inflation number. That's a worry, but that's not a big worry because it sort of resolves by itself. What's more worrisome in some ways and also somewhat comforting in some ways is the structural food inflation. Why am I saying that it's a comforting thing? Because part of the structural inflation, if not a large part of the structural inflation in India, is part of India's success. It is that as GDP started growing, there was more equitable distribution. Incomes, especially of the poorer people, especially in the rural areas, started going up. And what happened when income started going up is that people shifted their dietary habits. People shifted from eating more of cereal to more of protein. They shifted from eating grain to eating protein like milk, meat, eggs, legumes, vegetables. So that there's a structural component to India's inflation. one problem about India's food inflation is that we're a large country with 1.2 billion people. We cannot import food because the world food markets are notoriously thin. India doesn't even have to enter the food markets, even if there is some signal that India is going to enter the world food markets, prices just zoom up. So import is not an option for India's food problem. This year, of course, food inflation is a bigger concern because around the world, in the US, there is a drought, and that's going to affect the world food supply. So the story on food inflation is that the structural food inflation is, at least in part, a problem of India's success, with the success being growing incomes of the poorer sections of the population. Then there's global commodity prices plus depreciation. Commodity prices had come down after the Eurozone crisis had started getting deeper. But in India, we've not had the benefit of lower prices because the rupee depreciated. So the rupee cost of commodity prices had not declined as much as the dollar price. A very important commodity that we import is oil, crude oil. We import about 80% of our requirement. Oil prices had come down somewhat in May and June this year, but it started firming up again. And it's difficult to determine how oil prices will behave because to the extent that American recovery is weak, to the extent that there is a recession in Europe, there is lower demand, and that could soften prices. But on the other hand, if there is, for example, more quantitative easing in America here or in Europe, that could infuse liquidity into the global system. And if that liquidity is not absorbed in America, if that liquidity is not absorbed in Europe, where does it go? It goes into speculation. And the most important commodity people speculate on is oil prices. So there's two opposing trends here. Oil prices could come or could soften because of slow recovery. They could firm up because of quantitative easing. And add to all that is the geopolitical situation in the Gulf states, in Libya, in Syria, in Iran. So oil prices are very difficult to predict. The other driver of inflation is fiscal deficit. The government in India is running a large fiscal deficit. I'll come to that in a moment. But that also drives up inflation because it adds to demand. And finally, there's demand pressures. See, if in a rich country like this, if incomes go up, people don't go and spend that money immediately. There's marginal propensity to save is higher. For every dollar of income, people save more and spend less. But in a country like India, which is low income, when low income people's incomes go up, they tend to spend more. And when they spend more, there's more consumption, and there is, if there's no supply, that puts pressure on prices. So what's RBI done to control inflation? We have raised interest rates. We have tightened liquidity. The question that people ask me is, has the Reserve Bank succeeded in controlling inflation? I believe we have, although I'm an interested party, my response cannot be completely objective. But if you look at the number, it was 11%, it had come down to about 7%, so inflation has come down. But at 7% inflation, it is still above acceptable levels. So even as inflation has come down, I believe that the battle against inflation is not ended yet. We need to bring inflation down to more acceptable levels of 5% or even below 5%. One question about India is, India is an outlier in this growth inflation dynamics debate. Because if you look at other emerging economies, their growth has also come down because of the global situation. But as they had seen their growth coming down, they had seen their inflation coming down too. But India is an outlier because even as our growth has moderated, our inflation has not come down, and that's a worry. And that's because of some very unique India reasons I don't know very well. In fact, I challenged some of the students earlier in the smaller sessions to find answers to this question about why India is an outlier on this growth inflation story. There are lots of risks to the growth inflation situation, the global uncertainty. It's quite clear. Commodity prices, fiscal deficit, the monsoon performance. You know, up until 15, 20 years ago, we used to worry about the monsoon in India and whether that would affect our food production. But over the last, certainly over the last 5 years, I think India has drought-proofed itself to a large extent. Even if there's a failure of monsoon, we produce enough food. But I spoke a little while ago about the impact of the monsoon. The impact of the monsoon is not on the major cereal, but it's on oilseeds, it's on legumes. So those prices are going to be under pressure. Finally, the supply response. If people are consuming more and the economy is not able to produce that, there will be a demand-supply imbalance and there would be inflation. The challenge for us is to manage the growth inflation dynamics. See, everywhere, in every economy, including here in America, savers want high interest rates. When you put money in the bank, you want the bank to pay you a high interest rate. But people who borrow from the bank, they want a low interest rate. A bank at the same time cannot give a high interest rate to its savers and lend at a low interest rate to its borrowers. So the challenge for a central bank is how do you run the system in such a way that savers get a reasonably high interest rate and borrowers get a reasonably low interest rate. The other dilemma is that to control inflation, we need to keep interest rates high. But to support growth, we need to keep interest rates low. So the challenge is, how do you calibrate your interest rate such that you rein in inflation without hurting growth too much? The criticism against the Reserve Bank has been that even as we've run a tight monetary policy for the last 2 years, we've not been able to bring inflation down, that we've only been instrumental in moderating growth. In other words, the criticism has been that we failed in controlling inflation, but we paid the price without getting the outcome that we want in terms of growth. I can respond to that question at several levels. The first response is that we don't know the counterfactual. We don't know what inflation would have been if the Reserve Bank had not run a tight policy. It could have been 11%, 12%, maybe 15%. The second response to that question is that when you're running this growth inflation dilemma, some sacrifice in growth is an inevitable price to pay for low inflation. But that price is only in the short term. In the medium term, low and stable inflation is a necessary precondition for securing growth, because only in a stable inflation scenario can investors and consumers make informed decisions. The third thing, the third response to that question is that in a societal setup like India, the pro-growth lobby is very articulate. The corporate sector, the industry sector, people who invest who are agitated about high interest rates, they are very articulate, they're very vociferous, they get the point of view heard. People are hurt by inflation, largely the poor people whom inflation hurts. They do not have a mechanism for getting their voice heard. It's important for a public policy institution like the Reserve Bank to listen also to the silent voice of the poor and also take care of that constituency. So that's the first dilemma. Let me move on to the second dilemma, which is about the external sector. What is the external sector problem of India? The external sector problem is that we have a large current account deficit, and we are unable to finance that deficit. If you throw back to the last 20 years, India initiated reforms in 1991. For much of this period, we took the external sector for granted. It was the bulwark against the other sectors which were seen to be fragile, like our fiscal sector or monetary policy sector. But over the last 2-3 years, the external sector strains have been intensifying. Last year, for example, we had a current account deficit of 4.2%, and there's concern about what type of flows are financing that current account deficit. I won't bother you with this, but that just shows the current account deficit of India relative to the flows that come in to finance or not finance the current account deficit. But if you want to diagnose the external sector problem, why is India's current account deficit increased? That's quite easy to, in a textbook sense, it's quite easy to understand. It's because our exports have declined and our imports have increased. Exports have declined is quite easy to understand because Europe is in recession, America is in a slow recovery mode, so export demand around the world is low. But imports have increased because oil prices, as I told you, are high. See, when prices go up, what happens? People make an adjustment, right? You buy less of that, you use less of that. But that price response in India is not coming through because the government subsidizes petroleum sector prices. So ordinary consumers in India do not experience the movements in global commodity prices, especially the global oil prices. Because there is no price adjustment, even as global price is high, we keep importing the same amount and the rupee cost is high. And that puts pressure on the balance of payments. And what do we need? When you have a current account deficit, you need capital flows to come in. And capital flows are difficult to attract when your economy is going through a pressure situation. There's risk aversion around the world. People want to move away from emerging economies to their home economies. So what's been the result of this current account deficit and low capital flows? The result of this has been that the rupee has depreciated. One, the US also runs a current account deficit, but one big difference between America and the rest of the world, all the other countries in the world, is that America is hurt less by its current account deficit than every other country, because America has this privilege of issuing the world's reserve currency. The dollar is the world's reserve currency. So if, because America is the country that issues this reserve currency, the world is willing to lend to America at a low rate of interest, no rate of interest actually. Okay? So the America doesn't face that adjustment problem as every other country has to, as we are having to face that problem of a current account deficit. Okay? So how much has the rupee depreciated? Just look at the red line, that's the nominal exchange rate of the rupee. That's depreciated by about 20% since last year, since last August. Actually, I remember a date when the rupee started depreciating from August 4 of 2011. And why is August 4 important? August 4, August 5. That's when the US debt downgrade took place. If you throw back 1 year, on August 4 or 5 last year, S&P downgraded the US debt outlook. And that's had an enormous impact on practically every country in the world, including India. And that's when the rupee started depreciating. I'm not attributing the entire rupee depreciation to what's happening here. I'm saying that that's just the beginning, and there have been a lot of add-on factors, both domestic and external, over the last 1 year, which have put pressure on the exchange rate. What's been the impact of the exchange rate depreciation? The impact obviously has been that our imports, when the rupee depreciates, you would expect that your exports become competitive and that your imports are restrained. That's what textbooks tell you. But that's not playing out in India today. Our exports have not become competitive because it takes time for an export competitiveness to come through a currency depreciation. Besides, there is no demand for exports. India's about 25% of our exports are to Europe, and there is no demand from there. So exports have not picked up. On the other hand, imports have gone up. First, because of oil that I explained. Last year, we also saw a very big surge in import of gold. India has traditionally, historically had a love for gold. But what we saw last year was beyond the trend love for gold. It is that people saw this as a hedge against inflation. Inflation in India is going at 10-11%. There was no asset in the country that would give you 10-11% return. So people were taking a position on the gold. What has the Reserve Bank done to manage the exchange rate, in particular manage the volatility in the exchange rate? We've done three types of things. First, we've tried to curb speculation on the exchange rate. Second, we've tried to encourage capital flows. And third, we've also intervened in the foreign exchange market to manage the volatility. When you have a current account deficit and when your currency is depreciating, what you really want is capital flows. Ideally, you want capital flows just equal to your current account deficit. That's a sweet spot. Okay. But you never have it like that in the real world. Either capital flows are either too much or too little compared to what you want. In fact, I have a law about this, which is that you never get capital flows in the exact quantity or at the precise time you want. They're either too much, too late, too little, too early. If you look back over the last 7 years, you will find that capital flows have been quite volatile. In the pre-crisis period, 2005-08, we had inflows coming into emerging economies. Currencies started appreciating out of line with fundamentals, including the rupee. So we were saying, no, we want less capital flows. Then during the crisis, capital flows started moving back to home currency or to home countries. Actually, if you realize, at the depth of the crisis in 2008 and 2009, even as America was the center of the crisis, the dollar was appreciating. I mean, you would expect that the dollar would fall, right? But why did that happen? That happened because America is the reserve currency. In spite of the subprime crisis, the world trusts the American economy. This is the only large enough, robust enough economy to sustain that sort of pressure. So people were pulling out money, deleveraging, and putting it back in their home countries. Then there's the post-crisis period, 2010-11, when again we saw flows into emerging economies. Some of you might recall that in 2010, 2011, in the G20 meetings, practically the only topic for discussion was the currency wars, about how emerging economies are suffering because they're getting too much of capital coming in, quite unrelated to their fundamentals, much more than they actually would want, and they're having to take on an undue burden of the global economy. One thing about this international situation is that how quickly problems can escalate and how quickly problems can de-escalate by themselves. In 2010-11, we were talking about currency wars, and suddenly again in 2012, we're talking about not enough capital coming in. So your fortunes and your problems can change very quickly. This is about the change in worldview on capital flows. This is important for all of you young students to know. You know, for a long time, I have been in this business of negotiating with international institutions for at least the last 25 years. And if you read your textbooks, emerging economies have been told that you must open up your capital account. You must not intervene in your foreign exchange markets. The best thing for you to do is to let the markets function. And the dictum was that capital controls are bad, always and everywhere. But post-crisis, there is a change in that worldview. Now, the received wisdom is that it is appropriate, indeed advisable, for countries to intervene in their foreign exchange markets at some times to protect not only their economy, but the global economy. It's not just the emerging economies which intervene in the foreign exchange markets. A lot of advanced economies do as well. Japan does. Japan did last year when, after the tsunami, when they were getting a lot of yen flows back, the currency started appreciating. They intervened in the market. Switzerland, by far one of the most robust economies in the world today, and because it is a robust economy, Switzerland is defending its currency, intervening in the foreign exchange market, because what Switzerland experienced was that there's a crisis in the Eurozone, the confidence in the euro is declining, people need somewhere to put their money, they found Switzerland as a safe haven, they're putting money in Switzerland, the Swiss franc is appreciating, Switzerland is losing its competitiveness. So what Switzerland said is that we will defend an exchange rate of 1.2 francs to a euro, and they've been doing that for the last 1.5 or 2 years. America, I'm not saying America intervenes in the market directly, but if you look back over the last 2 years, the quantitative easing, Operation Twist, one of the criticisms against American policy in the global arena has been that America is systemically so large and so strong that even as it manages its domestic policy, it does not take into account the global externalities of its policy decisions. In particular, when America started doing quantitative easing, that was seen as a covert attempt to debase the dollar and improve America's competitiveness. So there is a ways of managing your currency, either by direct intervention or by indirect policies. I'm giving you this as an example, not necessarily attributing any particular policy to any country. Quite quickly, when we have capital flows, we can do two things. We can either control capital flows by taxing them. Some of you may have heard of the Tobin tax, that if India doesn't want capital flows to come in, we just put a tax on entry or on exit. Or we can intervene in the foreign exchange market. Both policy options come with costs. If you impose capital controls, or whenever it is convenient for you, and lift controls when it's convenient for you, people, the potential investor community around the world will lose confidence in the economy. They will see India as a fickle policy regime. They will not make long-term commitments. So one important thing for emerging economies to do is to project an image of stable policy. That is the problem with capital controls. The problem with forex intervention is that success is oftentimes very difficult. If India wants to defend a certain exchange rate, not necessarily that we want to do that, it is very important that we are successful and we are seen to be successful, because a failed defense of an exchange rate can be much worse than no defense. So when you want to intervene in the foreign exchange market, you have to be absolutely sure that your policy credibility is intact. In managing capital flows, we have lots of problems. I don't think I have the time to explain this, but I just want to say that no matter what option you undertake, you have a cost to pay, and the challenge for us is to manage the cost and benefit. So what's RBI's policy on capital account? RBI's policy on capital account is to run a stable regime so that we inspire the confidence of the international community, potential investor community, and gradually open up our capital account. Our policy on the exchange rate is to leave the exchange rate largely to the market and intervene only if it is affecting the volatility. Let me move on quickly to the third dilemma, which is about fiscal consolidation. Why is fiscal deficit a problem? This is a debate that's running in America. You have this fiscal cliff coming. It's a debate in Europe. It's a debate in India. It's a debate around many countries in the world. Fiscal deficits are bad for a number of reasons, because if governments borrow, there is so much less for the private sector to borrow. If governments keep borrowing too much, it can threaten debt sustainability. It can spill over and create balance of payments problems. It can exacerbate inflation. So any number of reasons for which you have to control fiscal deficit. What is India's fiscal deficit problem is somewhat different from, maybe not so different from, many other countries. We have a high fiscal deficit. Second, and importantly and worryingly, the governments in India borrow and use that money for current consumption, not for investment. If governments borrow money and use that for investment, they're creating tomorrow's production capacity. At least that's good. But if governments borrow that money and consume, that's a problem, because how do you repay this money? So that's the second problem about India's fiscal deficit. The third is that much of it is structural. I told you, it's not, you know, if you have a natural disaster, like Japan had a tsunami, okay? If you have a tsunami, government might need to borrow more. That is okay. That you know, that's cyclical. But if governments are having to borrow because they just don't earn enough by way of tax revenues, that's a problem, and that's the problem in India. And by far the biggest problem about fiscal deficits around the world and in India is the political economy challenges of managing fiscal deficit. You're seeing the debate here in this country about the fiscal cliff, about how in December 2012, some automatic tax increase and expenditure compression will take place if the government doesn't respond. You're seeing that debate in Europe about whether they must how much of austerity they must follow in order to support growth or regain growth. In India, the problem is all of that and more, because we have several states in the country. And even if states are ruled by different political parties, they're all united by one single theme, which is that they're all opposed to Delhi, the central government. Okay? So you have 28 states pulling in 28 different directions, but all of them resisting nationally optimal solutions because of what they see as short-term political gain or whatever the political calculation is. So the challenge for India is to get our fiscal consolidation in order. I'll skip this. I believe that India-China is quite a big story here. I was asking Kaushik back in Delhi, what should I speak and what should I say in Cornell? He said you must, at least for 2 minutes, speak about China. So I will spend exactly less than 2 minutes on China. Okay? You know, India-China comparisons have been very popular, and there's at least one. In the period 2003-2008, there was at least one book every week comparing India and China. I'm sure that some professors here, some may have written books on India-China, may have written theses on India-China, but there are important differences between India and China. China is demand constrained in the sense that there is not enough domestic demand. India is a supply constrained economy. There's demand, but we're not able to produce enough to meet that demand. That's one important difference. Second, China has a current account surplus. We have a current account deficit. Third, both India and China have to do rebalancing, but China has to move more from the export to domestic demand. India has to move more from domestic demand to exports. China has to rebalance from investment to consumption. India has to rebalance from consumption to investment. One big problem for China is whether it's getting locked in a middle-income trap. The big problem for India is whether we're getting locked in a low-income trap. So there's lots of similar questions which yield different answers for India and China. This is my last slide, because I must end on an optimistic note, which I believe in, which is that in spite of this short-term pressures that I've been speaking about for the last 45 minutes, I think the India growth story is still credible. You know, India, as I told you, grew at 6.5% last year. When I meet other central bank governors, other finance ministers, they say, oh, India is great. You're growing at 6.5%. We're hardly able to grow at 0.5%. I don't think that's good enough, because India has such poverty that we need to grow at 10% every year for the next 15 years just to catch up. So to say that India is growing at 6.5% when the rest of the world is growing only at 2.5%, and that's good for India, maybe it's good, but not good enough. We need to be growing at much faster pace. But I still believe that the India growth story, driven by our demographic dividend, driven by our savings potential, driven by the large middle class market, driven by the productivity improvement, driven by the entrepreneurism there is, I think is very much intact. And the India growth story is still credible, but it's not inevitable. The government, the Reserve Bank, the corporate sector in India, the financial sector in India have to do all the right things in order to make the India growth story an actual outcome. So thank you very much.
Governor.
Governor Subbarao has kindly agreed to take some questions, and so we have about a half an hour for that, no more. And I hope you stick around for that. And I would just ask you to keep your questions brief. That will allow us to have more of them. If the 2 minutes on China and India was not enough, here's your opportunity to pursue that issue further.
Thank you. Yes, yes.
First of all, thank you, Governor, for coming to speak to us. I was just wondering about India's debt rating. It's currently the lowest out of all the big countries.
Debt rating?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what impact that has on RBI and what you guys are doing to control that.
Perhaps repeat that question.
The question was about India's debt rating. What might be the prognosis, and what is RBI's preparedness to manage a downgrade. So for those of you who are not so clued up on India, S&P had had downgraded not the rating, but put us on a watch for a downgrade. A downgrade is not inevitable. They've said that it might happen in a 2-year time frame because of the growth slowdown, because of the external situation, because of the fiscal deficit situation. So the first answer is that our rating downgrade is not a given. It's still possible that we maintain this rating or we improve it. However, we need to be prepared for it. So if our rating downgrade takes place, it will have implications for our external sector about investors, global investors taking position on India. I understand that there are FI foreign institutional investors are driven by certain rules that they cannot invest in an economy which doesn't have a certain rating. So there might be some outgo, but we managed outflows in the past. We can manage them, I'm sure, but not that we want to manage a downturn or a rating downgrade. I hope it doesn't happen. We're doing several things to see that we maintain this rating. But should our rating downgrade take place, I think we are quite prepared. And you must also recognize that India of 2012 is quite different from India of 1991 when we had a balance of payments crisis. Today we have reserves of nearly $300 billion. In 1991 we had come down to $1 billion. Today we have strong financial markets. In 1991 we had no financial markets to speak of. So we are much better prepared to handle a downturn.
About 6-7 years ago, I read Neil Ferguson's book on the British Empire. Fascinating, well-written book, but I was absolutely shocked to learn that India's per capita income did not grow in the 150, 200 years the British ran India. Why are you growing faster now than you did in that period? And why are you also growing faster, a lot faster per capita, now than in the first decades of independence?
Thank you
what
for
did
that.
What they do?
I wish I could give a credible answer to that question. I have not really thought about it. I'm not a student of history of economic growth, but I do know that during the colonial period, India had low growth. And for 4 decades after independence, we had very low growth. And those of you who are familiar with India have heard of this phrase, the Hindu rate of growth. People said that India got locked into a low growth rate, a Hindu rate of growth. And that one of the tenets of Hinduism is fatalism, that you believe in destiny and you can't change it. So the tenet in India is that India is locked into this Hindu rate of growth, and this is God-given. You can do nothing about it. But then, as I was saying at the beginning of my talk, something remarkable happened in 2003-8 period. And I think we hit a sweet spot in the sense of a lot of positive things happening at the same time. One is this great moderation around the world of steady growth and low inflation. It had positive impact on every country, including India. Then productivity improvement. India's also had entrepreneurism, but that suddenly found an avenue for a spurt in that period. So I know that scholars are still trying to identify what really happened during that period, but 2003-8, we hit a sweet spot. The second part of your question is, why is that per capita income is improving now when it did not in the earlier period? Per capita income is improving because growth is faster and population growth has slowed down. So per capita income is improving. What is more important than per capita income improving, I'm going a little beyond your question, is that the income distribution is perhaps improving. That the benefits of growth are going to the low income groups, which is what we want. And that, as I said during my talk, is one of the drivers of inflation. So it's a part of the India inflation story is a story of success. Yes.
Can you please talk a little bit about the current India's unemployment rate? And what's your view on how much a central banker should interfere to try to reduce unemployment in general?
We have lots of problems about India's statistics. And one of the biggest problems is that we have no reliable unemployment numbers. So India's unemployment is notoriously difficult to put a number on. But what is certainly true is that hundreds of millions of people are, if not unemployed, certainly underemployed. They're locked in the agriculture sector, which is low productive. And so agriculture is only about less than 15% of our GDP, but 60% of our people are in the agriculture sector. So the prospects of agriculture are important not so much for growth, but for the well-being of a large section of our people. And some other dimensions of India's employment situation. You know, people talk about this demographic dividend that I also talked about it, that India, and uniquely in the world, is has this growing population, especially growing population in the age of 15 to 50, 65, whatever that age group is, which is productive, and that dependency ratios are coming down. This demographic dividend will result in more savings and therefore in more investment, and that is your route to success, economic success. But the biggest problem in this demographic dividend story is that you will get a demographic dividend only if you're able to employ all those people, right? People forget that necessary condition. So the big challenge for India is going to be to find jobs. The third thing I want to say about the job issue, again compared to India and China, is that China is a manufacturing economy. India is a service economy. And those of you studying textbook economics now would know that as countries develop, they go from primary to secondary sector to tertiary sector. And people say India had leapfrogged over this secondary sector, jumped suddenly from the primary to the service sector. That story served us well through the 90s. It doesn't serve us well now. Because if agriculture sector productivity goes up, it's going to release hundreds of millions of people. And those people have to be found jobs. The service sector in India cannot employ people in such large numbers. We've got to focus on the manufacturing sector. So that's very important for India, that we focus on manufacturing. The second part of your question is, what might the Reserve Bank be doing about it? You know, actually, just some background to this answer. Central banks have different mandates. The Bank of England, for example, has a single mandate, just inflation. They don't worry about unemployment, they don't worry about growth. The ECB has only an inflation target. The Fed, the US Fed, has two targets, inflation and unemployment. The Reserve Bank has multiple targets. We have inflation, unemployment, growth, stability, financial inclusion. So, you know, very broad mandate, which is typical of most emerging economy central banks. Apart from being a monetary policy authority, apart from being a regulator, we're also holders of development mandates. So what we try to do in the Reserve Bank is to support growth so that it supports employment. Yes. Yes, yes.
Thank you. Energy efficiency and specific electricity generation in India has been a hot topic the past couple weeks in the paper. You mentioned the fragmentation, if you will, between India's states and their opinion versus Delhi's opinion. Do you think that's something that contributes to that? And if so, what can be done?
Energy efficiency?
Or specifically around electricity generation. For
yeah.
The states.
Evidently, you're clued into India's energy problem. And last month, we had a blackout that was played up in the international press. In India, power is generated by the central government, central power utilities, state utilities, as well as private utilities. But electricity tariff is determined and regulated by the state governments. And because they're closer to people, because of their own political, economic calculations, electricity tariffs are not adjusted, even as the cost of generating electricity goes up, with the result that the demand adjustment that should take place does not take place. Electricity consumption keeps high, tariffs don't go up, the utilities come under pressure. And because the utilities are, at least some of them are largely owned by the state governments come under pressure. So that's the energy problem of India, which is that prices are not reflecting the market prices. The other thing about India's states is that a lot of state governments promise free power to farmers. So if farmers have no incentive to reduce the consumption, they keep pumping water using electricity to the extent that it is available. And that puts pressure on consumption and puts pressure on our demand-supply balance. So it's partly an economic problem of generating enough to meet the demand and making the price adjustment, partly a political problem, which is that the state governments are unwilling or unprepared to make the price adjustment. So Kaushik, you ask him later, he is much more equipped, having just returned from the government in Delhi, to give a more credible answer to that question. Yes.
Do you perceive that there is actually political will to reduce the deficit, reduce the subsidy load? Or do you perceive that there is some way that you can actually increase the efficiency of targeting subsidies? That will be a little bit short.
Well, whether there's political will or not is not a question that I'm equipped to answer, certainly not equipped to answer at a public forum. certainly, you know, one thing I can say with absolute certainty is that both the central government And most state governments are conscious of the importance of fiscal consolidation. And no matter how many experts, committees are appointed, there is no new ideas coming up of some magic way of reducing fiscal deficit without politically difficult decisions. One of the things that India has to do to manage the fiscal is to reduce subsidies. Why? Because what can governments do when they have a fiscal problem? They can either raise taxes or reduce expenditure, right? So leave alone taxes. On the expenditure side, you can only reduce discretionary expenditure, right? You can't reduce non-discretionary expenditure. Much of India's expenditure, public expenditure, is non-discretionary, at least in the short term. Salaries, pensions, interest payments on government debt, that cannot be reduced. Defense expenditure can be reduced, but it's difficult. That's a political issue again. So the only expenditure that can be reduced, or at least can be targeted, is subsidies. And also because several studies have shown that India's subsidies are inefficiently administered, that they're not going to the targeted people, that the government would be better off redesigning the expenditure programs for directed at the poor people. There's several hands. Yes, that young lady from there. Yes, you. Yes, you, ma'am.
So you mentioned that one of the factors that fuel this upturn, not fuel that caused the slow growth of the Indian economy is lack of investment. So do you think FDI is an answer to this? And if yes, your 2 cents on if it would fuel the lopsided development that India has been facing in the past decades?
Oh, I most certainly believe that FDI is at least part of the solution to investment slowdown. A lot of India's investment is domestic, okay, because our current account deficit, all said and done, is 4% of GDP last year, maybe less this year, we don't know. So if you are investing 30% plus, or indeed 38% before the crisis, much of our investment is domestic. But at the margin, we do need foreign investment, which is an important contributor to India's development. Now, the second question is about lopsided development. I don't know what you really mean, but foreign investors come in several forms, in a variety of ways. There is FDI, direct investment. There is FII. There is other ways of investing, like through QFIs, etc. But we prefer FDI because that is stable, at least in theory. And people who invest directly are taking a long-term stake in the economy, unlike FIIs, which are there for the short term. So FDI is good. If you're talking about spatial imbalances, that the FDI tends to go to certain states, that is true everywhere. And in fact, I think that's a good thing, because if some states find that FDI is not coming into their state and going to another state, at least they will then make their policies right to attract FDI to their state. Okay. Yes.
Me?
Yes. You.
So you mentioned that one of your goals was to increase manufacturing.
Excuse me?
You mentioned that one of your goals is to increase the manufacturing sector in India.
Yes.
So I was just wondering what you saw sort of the central bank's role in actually increasing that sector.
Well, the central bank doesn't have a direct responsibility for as narrow a goal as promoting the manufacturing sector, but we have a responsibility for promoting investment. And to the extent that the interest rate regime that we we formulate the policy for, to the extent that has an influence on investment or on manufacturing, we do have an obligation. But since you asked this question, and it's important to say this, interest rate is only one of the several variables that investors take into account. You cannot say that just if the Reserve Bank reduces the interest rate tomorrow, investment will just take off, because investment has declined for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is possibly high interest rate, but there are a number of other factors, governance deficiencies, infrastructure bottlenecks, other constraints that investors face that take on India's promise and performance. I'm looking at Professor Logowal.
Well, after I have time for a couple more, maybe the gentleman in the back who stood up just a second ago.
Yes. Yes, yes.
I'm digressing a little from the pure economics, unemployment rates and interest rates. There seems to be a complete policy paralysis in the present dispensation in India, with all these big anti-corruption movements going on and the opposition in complete tatters. Like, what is the future for reforms in India? Reforms in the retail sector, bureaucratic and governance reforms, in these reforms?
Well, policy paralysis is a phrase that's become increased in use. A lot of people use that, and the different people mean different things by that. I do admit that there are governance issues, and I do admit that governance issues, as I said in answer to the previous question, is one of the variables in determining current and future investment. But you asked a larger question about graft and corruption. Again, I want to say that it's not as if corruption in India has gone up suddenly in the last 2 years. It's not a step function that in 2010 it went up, corruption level went up like that. We've had corruption historically, and we've been, the government, public institutions have been trying to manage the problem of corruption. What's changed in the last 2 years is that there's much greater awareness of corruption. There's much greater demand for accountability from the government and from public institutions such as the Reserve Bank. And I think that's a good thing. And the recent agitation that's played out in India, the agitation against corruption, that's had a positive impact on the government, on the parliament, on public institutions. So I see something positive coming out of this. And I think that contrary to the way you worded your question, I think that India will be implementing reforms. Maybe slower than people want it, but certainly more steadily.
I was talking in terms of administrative reforms. Like someone just pointed about the energy sector. Yeah. In most of the state governments, I saw people who were experts in Sanskrit and philosophy and history heading the state electricity boards, and most of the people from the technical side complaining that they don't listen to our advisor, so some sort of getting professionals in the administration, and like various other reforms of the similar nature in various.
Yeah, I do take your point. There is enormous amount of talent in India's administration, but it is not as if we have all the wisdom. There is certainly a need and scope for much more expertise coming in here. I do not know about Sanskrit scholars becoming electricity regulators. That could well happen. But it's also possible that some of the regulators are studying Sanskrit. Okay, so.
So. I resent that implication about historians. we'll have one last question. Yes, the gentleman in the red. Yes.
Thank you. So a lot of talked about the policy reform, second round of reforms. In your opinion, what are these reforms that we need to, you know, implement?
Well, it's a very wide-ranging question. We need governance reforms, we need economic reforms, right? Governance reforms we talked about just now, which is reducing the level of corruption, increasing accountability, making life easier for business. In the World Bank's Doing Business Index, India's remained static at, I don't remember the exact number we have, but we've not improved. We should be improving on that. We should inspire the confidence of domestic and international investors. Now, coming to specifics, it's difficult to give an answer in 1 or 2 minutes, but we need to be improving our infrastructure. We need to be improving our tax regime. We need to be improving our investment regime, foreign and domestic investment regime. And most importantly, we must be improving the implementation of our policies at all levels. I know that that's an unsatisfactory answer to your question, but it's, unless you give me time for another lecture, it's difficult to answer that question.
Can I just maybe use my moderator's prerogative and ask one final question? You ended the talk, the formal talk, on an optimistic note. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about that big picture. And maybe I'll pose the question this way. What would a pessimist, what would be the more pessimistic conclusion be about what lies ahead, and what would your response be to that pessimist?
Well, if not the pessimist, at least to contest that India growth story, what do people say? That, look, you had growth of 9.3% in the pre-crisis years. That had nothing to do with you, what you've done at home. It's just happenstance. It's come because of what happened around the world. It was a benign global environment. India rode on that. And now when the world has gone down, you've gone down too. That could be the pessimistic story. But my response again, if you'd permit me, is that the ingredients of India growth story are intact. Even as the global environment helped, there was lots of domestic factors that contributed to the India growth story. Those domestic factors are intact. But again, it's not as if it's God-given that we do nothing and India will grow. We have to do a lot of things and do a lot of right things and do a lot of right things in the right way. Okay.
Well, I think that's a tremendous note on which to end. I want to first thank all of you for coming on a nice day, on a kind of really warm day in here, but and staying with us. I think this talk had lots to tell us, not only about India, but in an election year in our own country, I think there were lots of interesting connections and important connections that we could make. And of course now, let me have you join me in thanking Governor Subbarao.
Thank you. Once again, I appreciate this opportunity of speaking all of to all of you, and I wish you all the very best. Thank you.